From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Today, Democrats are celebrating one victory in the Georgia Senate runoffs, which gets them one step closer to a majority in the U.S. Senate. Raphael Warnock won against Republican incumbent Kelly Loeffler, and that makes him the first black senator to represent Georgia and only the second black senator to represent a southern state. Here's Warnock earlier on NPR's Morning Edition.
Welcome to the new Georgia. It is more diverse, it is more inclusive, and it readily embraces the future. And I'm the product of that, among other signs that you can see right on the ground here in this state.
The other race between Democrat John Ossoff and Republican David Perdue is still too close to call, but Ossoff is holding on to a narrow lead. Let's bring in Stephen Fowler, reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting. And Stephen, what a historic moment for Georgia. What's the feeling like there today?
Well, you know, for Democrats, it is a moment that has been years and years in the making, even dating back to the 2018 governor's race when Democrat Stacey Abrams came within 55,000 votes of flipping that seat. Democrats have put time and money and investment telling people that Georgia was a winning state and that it could turn blue. And now, with control of the U.S. Senate on the line, it's been pretty vindicating. And on the other hand, there are a lot of Republicans that are either in disbelief that the president lost and now the two Republican senators lost, or frustration that perhaps President Trump cost them these two seats.
Historically, runoffs in Georgia have been unfavorable to Democrats, to say the least. And we just heard Warnock say there, welcome to the new Georgia. What does his victory say about the evolving political landscape of the state, which you just referred to? And more importantly, will it be lasting?
Well, exactly. I mean, Georgia is a demographically and politically shifting state. In the last decade, Metro Atlanta in particular has gotten larger, younger, and more diverse. And that means that its politics has shifted. You have seen going from, you know, we haven't voted for a Democratic presidential nominee in almost 30 years until now. And now you see two U.S. senators that are Democrats. And people are thinking that in the next several years, you will see more and more state seats flipped in the legislature and statewide offices. And as that population continues to grow, Georgia will become a blue state.
Data from TargetSmart reveals that 50,000 black voters who did not vote in November showed up yesterday. That is an amazing statistic. What does it say to you?
Well, it's a cornerstone of what the Democrats said that they were going to do with the immense money and resources and time that they have amassed in this runoff. And particularly in Southwest Georgia, Georgia's Black Belt, where politicians typically don't go. They put a lot of energy and investment in, and that area of the state really overperformed both in early voting and Election Day voting and ended up being the decisive margin.
What are you hearing from Kelly Loeffler's campaign today? Is there a sense from her or others that perhaps tying herself so closely to President Trump and his claims of baseless claims, by the way, of election fraud may have hurt her?
Well, what we're hearing from both Republican Senate campaigns is not very much. They are of the mantra that every vote needs to be counted and that they still believe there is a pathway to win because there are still about 50 to 60,000 absentee ballots that need to be counted in counties. Now, mind you, it's mostly Democratic-leaning counties that have those ballots. But, you know, the votes are not all the way in, so there is still a sliver of a chance that it could go the other way or at least be in the margin for a recount, but that's extremely unlikely.
Well, right, and the race between John Ossoff and David Perdue is much closer than Warnock's. Have you heard anyone yet question the integrity of that vote? I mean, as you say, we're close to a recount, but how close are we?
Well, right now, that race is within the margin for a recount, but Gabriel Sterling with the Secretary of State's office just held a briefing this morning saying that looking at where the remaining votes are coming from and the partisan lean of it, that likely it would push both Democrats well outside the margin for a recount and make them the likely U.S. senators. And we have heard one notable exception to someone who is calling it a rigged election, the president, of course. He tweeted that there are scoundrels toying with Senator David Perdue and that it was a rigged election.
I just got 30 seconds here, but I want to briefly get your take on Democratic State Rep Vernon Jones saying today that he's now a Republican because he believes the party is, quote, in desperate need of leaders that know how to fight.
Well, Vernon Jones has always been a gadfly in Democratic politics, and as he leaves the state house and no longer becomes a representative, it's a not surprising next step.
All right. Stephen Fowler of Georgia Public Broadcasting, thanks so much. Thanks for your work.
Thank you.
Well, crowds of pro-Trump demonstrators are gathered in the streets of D.C. as Congress meets to officially certify the Electoral College votes in the 2020 election. But here's something we haven't seen in our lifetime. About a dozen Republican senators and more than 100 Republican representatives are opposing the certification, even though there's no credible evidence of the widespread voter fraud they point to. NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell joins us now with the latest. And Kelsey, these Republican objectors won't change the outcome of the 2020 race. We know the process today is largely ceremonial. So what's the significance of this event today?
Yeah, that's right. This will not change the course of the election. This is an opportunity for Republicans to speak up and, you know, speak to the voters who are largely Trump supporters who have responded to the misinformation that has been put out there about widespread voter fraud. We should say that numerous federal agencies and Attorney General William Barr have confirmed that there was not widespread voter fraud. But nonetheless, this is coming up in Congress, and several of the senators who say they're going to object have explained that they feel like this is their only chance to speak up for the people who feel disenfranchised in this process.
How long could this certification process take? Are we in for an all-nighter?
We very well may be in for an all-nighter. So every time they object, they can object to each state individually as long as there is one member of the House and one member of the Senate who agree to object to a state's count. That forces up to 2 hours of debate. So if you go through and add together all of the states that they could object to, the list is around six, that could take a really long time. I have been told, though, that it's more likely that they'll object to close to three states. Some of that has to do with just the timing and when states are called, because this will happen in alphabetical order. We will hear this start with Arizona, and then we'll watch things play out from there.
Okay, alphabetical order. Who are the main Republican senators leading this effort?
It's being led largely by Ted Cruz of Texas and Josh Hawley of Missouri. Cruz is the one who got together a group of about a dozen senators who joined together to say that they would be objecting. You know, Cruz has clarified to some degree, basically saying that he's focusing on calls for an electoral commission, not setting aside the election result. But the effect is still the same. He's still objecting to the electors from individual states.
Okay. And at the same time, there are several Republicans who have spoken out against it. What does this tell you about divisions within the party?
You know, it's actually about two dozen Senate Republicans. So double the number of people who are willing to object are the ones saying that they absolutely should not be objecting. You know, they're expected to join all of the Democrats in easily voting down these objections. Republicans are split not just about this, but they're split as they're deciding who the party is in a post-Trump era. You know, they have been facing a lot of divisions about the culture of their party, the policies that they want to pursue. And there are really deep concerns about some of the more extreme positions that we're hearing from some factions of the Republican Party. If you talk to people like Senator Mitt Romney, he says that what is happening here is it's senators going against their constitutional duty. And he has vehemently rejected the idea that Republicans should be objecting to this in any way, shape or form.
And Vice President Pence will be presiding over the joint session. Trump has repeatedly called on him to reject the certification. But Pence doesn't really have that power, right? So what kind of bind does this put him in?
I mean, it is certainly a political and perception bind. But we do understand that Vice President Pence intends to follow the law as he presides. That's what he has told our colleague Tamara Keith. Advisors have told our colleague Tamara Keith. So it is our expectation that he will follow along. But the president does still have a Twitter account with millions of followers and has been exerting pressure on Republicans in the House, the Senate, and the vice president using that account over the past several days.
We heard Peter checking in on Georgia. This drama in Congress comes as Republicans face a defeat in the Senate runoffs in Georgia. Chuck Schumer has already declared himself to be the next Senate majority leader. How could this play into events today?
Well, this is certainly a difficult time for Republicans who are having a big split within their party put on a massive public display. And this is, as I said, a moment where the party really has to decide what they stand for, who they will be, who their next leaders will be. And having lost the potentially lost control of the Senate at the same time as this vote is happening really does make a very, very, very clear display of who is, you know, heading in which direction. And I think that a lot of voters in the public are going to be watching that.
Yeah. Will you be watching every minute of today on through the middle of the night?
Well, someone from our team certainly will be. If it is not me, there will always be somebody from the NPR congressional team watching this.
That's NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell. As always, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And it's a big day in Washington with a joint session to certify the results of the Electoral College. President-elect Biden won 306 electoral votes over President Trump's 232. This certification would normally be straightforward, but today about a dozen Senate Republicans and some Republicans in the House have said they'll object, likely causing hours of debate, even though there's clearly no chance of changing the results. We'll hear more from one of those Republicans elsewhere in the program. But first, let's check in now with Democratic Congressman Ro Khanna of California, who is voting to certify the results. We spoke with him this morning, and I asked him about the Republican objections to certification.
It's an unfortunate assault on American institutions, on American democracy. It's the opposite of conservatism. But what gives me hope is the numerous Republican officials in states and at the local level who do believe in American democracy. The American democratic ethos is inculcated in our country at a very young age, and seeing them stand up for democracy has been heartening, and I have no doubt that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris will be inaugurated on January 20th.
Republicans have pointed out that a number of Democrats have actually done this in the past. In 2005, for example, though the numbers were small and the Democratic presidential candidate had already conceded, did Democrats pave the way for what we're seeing today?
No, not at all. There were a number of people who had objections on particular issues, but you never saw a concerted effort by the person who lost the election do this. And if anything, Al Gore, who had a very legitimate grievance in Florida, did the gracious thing and concede. And you never saw senators and party leaders call for this. So it's at a completely different level.
Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, today, no matter what happens with these debates, the election results have nearly no chance of changing. But President-elect Biden will take office with a portion of the country believing he is not the legitimate winner. Are Democrats going to reach out to those voters to regain some trust there to move on from this election? Do you think that's even possible?
Yes, we have to. I mean, even if you look at the results last night in Georgia, this country is divided. We're divided between rural communities and urban communities. We're divided between places that have been left behind from economic prosperity. We have a task of delivering for all Americans, and particularly for left behind communities. I think that can start with a strong infrastructure bill. It can start with $2,000 checks that were very popular in places like Georgia. So I believe the President-elect Biden, with his agenda, can deliver for these communities and slowly earn their trust.
If Democrats do control the Senate, the House, and the presidency, what should the priorities be?
The first priority should be the $2,000 check. So that was on the ballot in Georgia. Then we need another strong COVID relief package, one that's going to help get the vaccine distributed and distributed faster, one that's going to get money to state and local governments for local hospitals, for schools, for their needs, and then an infrastructure bill that's going to help with broadband and going to put people back to work in communities.
Congressman Ro Khanna, Democrat of California, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And let's try to better understand why the coronavirus vaccine rollout is so dangerously slow. 17 million doses have been delivered to states, but fewer than 5 million of them have been put into people's arms. And it varies widely from state to state. In South Dakota, for example, more than 60% of doses have been used, according to a New York Times database. But in Kansas, it's just 15%. Epidemiologist Oscar Allen works closely with local health departments. He's chief of programs and services for the National Association of County and City Health Officials. He joins us now by Skype. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Sure. So who needs to shoulder the blame here? Is it the federal government, the states, or even the hospitals and the clinics where these shots are being given?
There's share across the platform. What do I mean by that? We recognize that the push was to get vaccines out. Where I think we've recognized that there's been some concerns and challenges is in moving from the vaccine delivery to the mechanisms that are necessary for us to get vaccines into the arms of people. And when you place things with a variant approach, meaning not everyone's doing the same thing and recognizing that there's some restrictions and challenges for others, it really becomes a problem. And recognize, of course, that the states were given a very short window to turn around vaccination plans. And I can tell you that many of the local health departments who have been engaged in vaccinations over the course of history were not necessarily engaged in that level of planning. So there's several efforts that needs to be filled out to that extent.
To your point, it is so variable from state to state and place to place. We see lines of seniors still camping out overnight in Florida to get a shot. In states like Oklahoma, health departments are posting appointments on their Facebook pages and then websites to sign up for a vaccine are crashing and failing all over the country. Does any of this seem effective to you? I mean, there's so many pain points in getting this thing distributed.
Yes, those pain points are pain points that we've been discussing and lamenting about for years. We've been talking about the investment in the public health infrastructure, which not just includes that of the technology, but also of the people. Public health as a whole has lost about 30,000 staff in the last 10 to 15 years. Now, you add on top of that the impact of this particular pandemic. We recognize that, especially from the local health jurisdiction's perspective, they've been at the front lines of addressing contact tracing, community education, community mitigation efforts. And then on top of that, now they have the responsibility of shifting to going into the mass vaccination. So there is a significant level of frustration, angst, and bewilderment, because when you think about the ability for us to roll out such a critical resource, the investment in the infrastructure is going to be important. So do we have mechanisms to ensure that the data is really streamlined so that when folks need to make appointments, it is easily done, that we don't run into issues of, you know, crashing of websites, et cetera? Do we have a streamlined process to ensure that when individuals are approved for vaccinations, that they in turn are able to process the paperwork so it reduces the length of time that they have to sit in line or receive vaccines? And to the variability, we recognize that there's an ACIP recommendation for who gets what first. But as you have clearly seen, some states have elected to go a different path. And that in of itself does shift as to how you will accommodate and develop the logistics to get this thing done.
Oh, one of those states making changes is Maryland. Here's Governor Larry Hogan, whose plan includes preventing facilities from getting new vaccine doses if they haven't given out at least 75% of them. And he's also calling for increased staffing.
We have already identified 700 qualified people who are ready and willing to assist local health departments and other clinics with the administering of shots, and we're sharing that information with county health departments to help enable them to expand their clinics to 7-day-a-week operations.
Even that is not easy to do. We heard from a nurse in Arizona, where I'm based, who said she's trying to volunteer to help with getting injections into people's arms, but the process is so long and cumbersome that she couldn't figure out how to do it. So how do we address this staffing problem?
Yeah, staffing is a significant concern. If there's a goal of really increasing the vaccination in our population, we need to make sure that the staffing is available and we're able to address issues such as liabilities, you know, just-in-time training, as we say. The governor just mentioned in your clip the ability to support local health departments. I can tell you, we have local health departments in other states that have not received one vaccine dose or delivery to enable themselves to vaccinate either their staff or even others in the community. So this disparity is such a concern. But I do agree that they should be a concerted effort to identifying what are the available resources that we have on hand, what are those backfill supports, such as the volunteers and others who are willing and able to help support those who have been totally inundated in this pandemic, and working logistically. We have this process from anthrax smallpox days of 9/11 called incident management. You know, when you think about the role of unified command, incident management, and the ability to process these logistics, it can be done. We have systems in place to adopt them. I think we just need to reconcile and repivot so that we're doing it efficiently, effectively, and with that target in mind.
Well, we also see that Governor Cuomo in New York is threatening to fine hospitals that don't use up their shots quickly enough. Let's end on a positive note here. Have there been changes that you've seen at the state level and local level in recent weeks that are working, that are helping to get those shots into arms?
Yeah, we have several counties that have actually illustrated the value of how they can work in efficiency. There's one in New Bedford, Massachusetts, who, by virtue of identifying their essential workers, they were able to set up efficient clinics where folks came in, got vaccinated, in and out, to the fact that they are now waiting to see if they can move on to the next tier because they're so efficient in the delivery. There are others who were able to accomplish by developing drive-through clinics. That was Carlton County in Minnesota. You know, they were able to really roll out this whole concept of management of traffic flow, ensuring that this drive-through clinic can work in a way that individuals who were expected to be vaccinated were able to get their shot. Now, granted, it's a smaller county, but these are just examples of how you can use technology, you can use this information of process and flow to really be efficient and get on top of this by virtue of working together. So, for example, having a vaccine website that allow people to find out where they're eligible for and how they can register and maybe even take care of some of the paperwork issues so that by the time they get to their venue, it's a much smoother process. These are things that are very capable of being enacted, and I think we're all desperate to ensure that we can implement them in a way that makes sense.
Oscar Allen is an epidemiologist and chief of programs and services for the National Association of County and City Health Officials. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You have a blessed day.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
Prosecutors in Kenosha, Wisconsin, will not file charges against the officer who shot and paralyzed Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Blake was shot last summer, 3 months after a police officer killed George Floyd in neighboring Minnesota. And these two cases became a flashpoint that sparked a wave of protests throughout the world. And for more on this decision, we have with us Angelina Mosier-Salazar, a reporter with WUWM. Welcome, Angelina.
Hello, Tanya.
You were there yesterday when the district attorney announced he would not file charges against this officer, Rustin Shesky. Video of this shooting was widely shared, and it appears to show the officer shooting Blake seven times as Blake tries to get into his car. What do we know about how the prosecutor came to this decision?
The district attorney in this case would say that the disturbing video footage you and I and many others saw was only part of the story. DA Gravely says he conducted an extensive investigation, and after looking at the full body of evidence, he essentially determined that the officer acted in self-defense. Now, I do want to make an important note here. In Kenosha, police officers do not wear body camera footage. So the footage that was widely circulated was taken from a bystander who was across the street filming the incident.
Mm-hmm. And Wisconsin law holds that officers can shoot if they have reasonable belief that firing is necessary to protect themselves. Blake's father has asked for Kenosha to stand up and make noise about this decision. How are people in Kenosha responding to this news? What's the sentiment?
Well, there certainly are mixed emotions, both strongly critical and supportive of the decision. But I don't think anyone can say that this was a surprise. I had one woman message me and say, you know, we knew that this was coming, but it still hurts. And Tanya, you mentioned Jacob Blake's father, and he certainly says that this is not the end, that the next step for him is Congress, where he will actively be lobbying to change the laws that he sees protects law enforcement officials.
The FBI also has opened a civil rights investigation, which remains open. So what's next for this officer?
Yeah, a federal investigation is underway, but important to note, also ongoing are federal investigations into arson, rioting, and other crimes that occurred in Kenosha this past August. So we won't know definitively what will be the outcome of those investigations until they are completed. But as for Officer Shesky, the officer who shot Jacob Blake multiple times in the back, and who has also been employed by the Kenosha Police Department for 7 years, we know that he was placed on administrative leave after the shooting. At this point, we're not certain if he will be brought back onto active duty, and if so, when.
One other thing with the 30 seconds I have with you, a teenage gunman named Kyle Rittenhouse that we know about turned up at the protests and shot and killed two people. He's currently free on bail. What's next in his case?
Tanya, when it rains, it pours. Yesterday, we had the arraignment in his case where he is being charged for killing two people and seriously injuring another person. To those charges, he pled not guilty.
That's Angelina Mosier Salazar. She's a reporter at WUWM. Angelina, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
In Washington, D.C. today, members of Congress are engaged in a dramatic debate that will eventually certify Joe Biden's victory in the presidential election. But there's another scene worth noting on the streets of Washington where President Trump's supporters, galvanized by his false claims of a stolen election, have taken to the streets in protest. Far-right messaging boards have even encouraged people to bring their guns. Dominique Maria Bonessi from member station WAMU has been out reporting. And Dominique, this is actually the second day of protests, but this is the big one because of what's happening on Capitol Hill. What have you seen out there?
That's absolutely correct. Yes, today people have gathered early morning about 8, 9 o'clock. Parking lots in downtown D.C. were packed. People were walking towards the Ellipse, which is just south of the White House. And there were two big jumbotrons where Rudy Giuliani, Donald Trump Jr., and Donald Trump were also speaking.
All right. Well, let's hear a little bit from President Trump. Here he is.
We're gathered together in the heart of our nation's capital for one very, very basic and simple reason: to save our democracy.
That's President Trump today in Washington. I'll point out that many Americans believe that what the president is doing is actually undermining democracy. And Dominique, we're seeing some reports out of far-right message boards where users are taking President Trump's tweets and using them as a call to action. Messages on those boards have told supporters to bring guns and to, quote, stack bodies. How are people feeling about this, the threat of violence today?
So as far as reporters are concerned, there's definitely been a heightened tension here. This is the third protest D.C. has seen since the election. The Trump supporters have come out in about, this is probably the largest rally that we've had of the three. And people are, you can feel the tension in the air that if something doesn't go right, this is like the last stand for a lot of people. Many people I've also spoken with are saying, you know, they're worried that, you know, a Biden presidency would mean communism for this country. And that they prefer a Trump presidency because he is defending their rights and defending democracy.
Yeah. And people can probably tell you're on a cell phone there. That's because you're on the scene of the protest. A little tough to hear, but thank you for being there. Just real quick, what's the police presence like to the point you just made?
So, yes, police were out in Freedom Plaza, which is just a little bit east of the White House, putting up signs saying no rifles, no guns allowed at First Amendment protests, demonstrations. I have not seen anyone with a weapon yet today. But it's still early in the day. A lot of times we've seen these protests get violent towards the nighttime and towards when it gets dark.
What do you expect next? I mean, because these protesters are rallying for a Trump victory that they believe has actually happened. The results will be certified, although it'll take a while. It'll be certified likely later today, late today in Congress. Is it realistic to think that these protests will fade away after today, or are you expecting more?
What I've been hearing from people today is that this is the last stand, but if this does not happen for them, if President Trump is not reelected, if the election is not certified for him, they will continue protesting. I'm hearing people, some say even that they would be justified to be violent if they do not get Trump back in office.
All right, we're going to hope that does not happen. Dominique Maria Bonessi from member station WAMU on a cell phone in the field there at the protest in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
In Los Angeles County, ambulance workers are being told not to transport patients to hospitals who have a little chance of survival. This stunning directive is in response to the surge in COVID-19 cases. Hospitals in LA County are at full capacity, and the number of people who have tested positive for the virus is now at 841,000. Brian Fula Napoli is a manager for AmWest Ambulance Service in North Hollywood, and he joins us to talk about the tough decisions his crews are having to make. Brian, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tanya. Good to be with you.
Yes, so these numbers are really hard to wrap your head around. Just here in Los Angeles, nearly 8,000 people are in the hospital right now with COVID-19. The county health department, as I mentioned, has not only told you and other ambulance services not to take patients with little chance of survival, but also to conserve oxygen. Describe for us what your crews are currently experiencing out in the field.
Yes, that's correct. We are being told that after 20 minutes of resuscitation efforts in the field, that if we do not get spontaneous perfusion with the patient, meaning that the chance of survival would practically be slim to none, that we should not be transporting the patients to the hospital due to the fact that there are no beds currently in Los Angeles County. This has been standard protocol and practice in other parts of the country and something the county has been talking about moving towards for a while now. So although it sounds draconian, it is numbers-based. It's not, you know, something just pulled out of the air. It's great that the public is aware of what's going on, that they're paying attention now. Our crews absolutely are spending 6 to 8 hours in the ambulance with COVID-positive patients and other types of patients waiting for beds. So it is a crisis that we are in right at the moment.
Can you explain what conserving oxygen means for the folks out in the field?
Sure. So conserving oxygen with the directive that's been ordered is that unless a patient's oxygen saturation level is less than 90%, that we would not give oxygen. If they fall below the 90% mark, we would then throw them on oxygen and bring them up to a 90% saturation level, meaning that you have 90% oxygenation of the blood throughout your body. This is being the number that of 90 has been adjusted because of the low oxygen supply throughout the county. Luckily, the Army Corps of Engineers came into Los Angeles County, I believe yesterday or the day before, and is working hard to try to increase the amount of oxygen that the county has on hand.
Nearly 40% of the patients your service transports are considered COVID positive. And over the last 3 weeks, you've had several workers diagnosed with COVID-19. First of all, how are they? And how has this impacted your ability to service the county?
Yes, we are all dealing with the impacts of COVID-19. And, you know, we definitely have some employees that have contracted the virus. They are doing well. Thank you for asking. In the way that it's affected AmWest Ambulance, when you have employees, your frontline workers that are out sick, it requires you to still staff the units that are required within the county. So we're investing in overtime and double time to make those expenditures to make sure that the residents of Los Angeles County are taken care of. But it's a taxing toll. It's extra hours, extra money, extra stress that the employees are going in and day out with.
These are directives that you all are adhering to. But I imagine it doesn't make it any easier.
It does not. The COVID-19 comes with a plethora of issues, whether it be from the emotional toll, the mental toll, the physical toll, the need and the want for the vaccine. And, you know, we have only 30% of the vaccine that's been given out of what the state has on hand. I have employees ask me this morning when I came into work, when are we getting the vaccine? And I don't have an answer for them. And that's messed up.
I would assume as medical workers that they would be at the top of the list.
So unfortunately, that's above my pay grade and other people make those decisions. I know that the county is working hard on trying to get it released. But at this point, it's been 3 weeks that it's been released, and here at AmWest Ambulance, our employees still do not have access to the COVID-19 vaccines.
You call this truly a healthcare crisis that is expected to get worse. What do you want the general public to know right now?
Yes, this is a crisis. And what we really want the public to understand is, you know, our owner here at AmWest Ambulance, our CEO, Boris Krutanov, recently said that we're at war with the invisible enemy. This virus does not discriminate by age, by gender, by race. It can affect each and every one of us. And what we can do for ourselves and for each other is make the best decision to protect ourselves, to protect others.
Brian Fulanapoli is a manager at AmWest Ambulance in North Hollywood, one of the many ambulance services directed by LA County not to transport patients with little chance of survival to area hospitals, which are overwhelmed with COVID-19 patients. Brian, thank you so much for your time and your work, and please stay safe.
Thank you, Tanya.
The economic fallout from the coronavirus pandemic means more people are going hungry. That's true in Maine, but at the same time, much of the state's seafood harvest is having a hard time finding a market. Now, a new program is addressing both challenges at once. Maine Public Radio's Fred Bever reports.
On a recent morning, Brian Pierce and his two-man crew motored the 45-foot gillnet trawler, the Graceland Jane, back to a pier in Portland, Maine, after 2 days at sea.
We got 4,000 or 5,000 pounds total. Pollock, about 20 miles out.
Baskets full of fish are hoisted into the sky, gleaming like silver ingots, and dumped into a chute. Thanks to a new program called Fishermen Feeding Mainers, much of the catch will be bought at a guaranteed floor price of $2 a pound, then shipped to food banks and schools around the state. It's a lifeline for fishermen like Pierce in this year of COVID. Starting last spring, demand for most fish dropped steeply as restaurants closed and access to foreign markets was shut off.
Oh, I didn't fish all summer. I didn't start fishing until the project came about. So once that happened, I started going full time because I knew, you know, I had a guaranteed price. I knew what I could make, you know, and I said, well, that takes all the guesswork out of it. I'll go for that. I'll do it.
A nonprofit called the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association spearheaded the effort. Program manager Mary Hudson says the value of the state's groundfish harvest dropped by almost 75% this year. And even at pennies per pound, some of it went unsold.
So we were, you know, trying to figure out a way to help them out throughout this. And at the same time, reading about food insecurity in Maine and people really struggling during the pandemic. And it just kind of seemed like the perfect marriage of two causes.
The program was launched with a $160,000 anonymous donation, $200,000 in pandemic relief funds, and individual contributions. And people are lining up for it.
This is about 1,700 pounds of fish, approximately. And this is the most we've done so far, so it keeps growing.
That's Nori Hilton, who was busy in a Portland warehouse stacking boxes of monkfish. Since spring, every Saturday has seen dozens of food brigade volunteers like Nori meet here to pack up boxes and bags full of fresh produce, and now high-quality, high-protein fish to be delivered around the city. Much of it is destined for Latino, Asian, and African immigrants who work in Maine's big meat and seafood processing plants. Sebastian Limones is an immigrant from El Salvador who picks lobster and packs fish for local companies. The seafood industry's pandemic-driven dislocations have cost him work. So in addition to volunteering with the food brigade, he is, for now, a client. Limones says his boss tells him there won't be any work for at least the first 2 months of 2021. He's one of 2,000 people the food brigade is serving, and there is a growing wait list. Experts estimate that need has risen more than 20% due to the pandemic, roughly 7 million meals worth. The Fisherman Feeding Mainers program is a new tool in the statewide effort to knock those numbers down. And its beneficiaries aren't just fishermen and the hungry.
If it weren't for that program, we would be seeing next to nothing.
Nick Pappas is general manager at the Portland Fish Exchange, which operates the auctions that are held when hauls come in, but loses revenue when prices fall so low that the fishermen keep their boats tied to the dock.
When our boats do well, we do well. By this fixed fee that has already been set aside for these boats with these fish, you know, we get to take an okay amount, which has helped kind of keep the lights on.
Back at the Portland Pier, fisherman Rob Odlin says by strengthening links throughout the seafood supply chain, the program is benefiting even those like him who aren't direct participants.
Everybody wins. The boats, the dock workers, the harbor, cutters. I mean, lobstermen get the reduced price on the bait because it's here instead of having to travel. It's the name of the game. 30, 40 miles away, you got almost an unlimited supply of dinners for people.
So far, Fisherman Feeding Mainers has donated more than 150,000 meals worth of fresh protein from the Gulf of Maine. Program officials say requests from community partners are rising with the latest coronavirus surge, and they are planning a new round of fundraising. For Here and Now, I'm Fred Bever in Portland, Maine.
And a moment now to say goodbye and thank you to a very important person on our staff.
Our senior technical director, James Trout, we call him JT, is leaving the show today after 9 years at our home base, WBUR. In a nutshell, JT makes this show work. He's often on the audio controls, and he's the commanding, comforting voice in my ear, playing air traffic control, so to speak. JT also has recorded and mixed some of our most memorable interviews.
And Tanya, our staff is scattered all over the country. I'm at home in Phoenix. You're inside your closet in Los Angeles. Robin's in Boston. JT makes this complex web of connections around the country and really the world sound almost easy. And I am in awe every day.
JT, best of luck to you. And thank you from all of us.
I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.